Good morning. You're listening to KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio. You're also listening to Praxis. I'm your host, Taylor, and today I have a show mostly prepared for you about a topic that was really in the public conversation all summer, spring and summer, but kind of faded out a little bit, and that's a bit disturbing for all of us. And that topic is surveillance, mass surveillance, state surveillance, U.S. surveillance of the rest of the world, including us. And what does that mean? And what are some myths and facts and interesting information and history? And hopefully we can make it all come together. So originally, the reason that this topic came to my attention, other than just reading about it, Stage Left Theater Association, who I am a big fan of in Spokane, our only small kind of radical theater company here, is putting on a reading, a staged reading of The Back of the Throat, which is by Youssef El-Gundi. And it's about, specifically, it's about surveillance and federal harassment of Arab Americans after 9/11, aided and abetted by the Patriot Act. And that's going to be presented January 17th through 19th. So that is, I don't have this written down, Tuesday. That's this weekend. So I was hoping to talk with some of the people involved in putting on the production, and we just didn't connect soon enough. So I'm hoping that I'll be there at one of those shows. Tickets are available online. All of their information is at SpokaneStageLeft.org. So that got me thinking about it. I was kind of casually planning a show, hoping that we could get together. Since we can't, I think it's still a cool topic. So that's what we're going to do. And I think a lot of the time, folks have the impression that surveillance is something that's really ramped up since the Patriot Act, since 9/11 in this country. But really, there's a much longer history, and many folks point to World War I as when it kind of all began. So I'm going to start there, I think, and then we can talk about a little bit about the state of surveillance now. I want to share a really good TED Talk from TEDx Brussels about this topic and about the NSA revelations that Edward Snowden leaked. And specifically, what I really like about the talk that I'll share is that the speaker, Mikko Hipponen, shares that the U.S. is only, was the big argument from the NSA was that no one should worry because we're only spying on foreigners. And he pointed out that 96% of the world's population is made up of foreigners, non-U.S. citizens. So, yeah. Most of the world should be aware of all of this happening. And most of the world is a lot more aware than folks here are. So this is just a short article by David Silby, and it's about this, the beginning of an official surveillance state in the U.S., 1917. So it's actually Lon Strauss who wrote this. It's a guest post on David Silby's blog at chronicle.com. And he says, there has been a recent uptick in the news over concern about the United States becoming a surveillance state. The Guardian and the Washington Post published articles about the National Security Agency's practices that have sparked a renewed debate over surveillance, national security, and civil liberties in America. Journalists have posed questions about whether a democratic surveillance state is possible and the role of U.S. companies willingly handing personal information to a government agency. While there are and should be real concerns regarding national security and civil liberties, it will surprise no one that this discussion is not new. When engaging complex historical debates, it's always appropriate to quickly re-examine its beginnings, where the American surveillance state had its origins, the First World War. The United States' entrance into the First World War in April 1917 marked America's first truly organized attempt at keeping watch on its citizens. There were real and justified fears of German agents in America, but just as importantly, some citizens did not trust their neighbors. Not only were a fifth of the American population of German heritage, but there was a large number of radicals, too. After all, almost 1 million voters cast their ballot for socialist Eugene Debs in the 1912 presidential election. Anarchists like Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman were loose. Big Bill Haywood was running rampant with his fellow syndicalists in the IWW. There were alleged pacifists, such as the International Bible Students Association, who proclaimed to abhor violence until the Armageddon. Additionally, there were perceived slackers, such as Roger Nash Baldwin, who claimed he was assisting the government with classifying conscientious objectors, but was really, according to some authorities, convincing draft-age men to avoid their American duty by serving the nation in uniform, according to some notion of conscience that was not connected to a legitimately recognized religion. So what was to be done? If the debate over neutrality and divided public opinion on the war waging in Europe was any testament to possible frictions in a nation that was as of yet 100% American, then Congress would need to take action to curb dissent at a time when the country needed to mobilize for an industrialized total war like the world had never witnessed before. Thus, legislators passed the Espionage Act of 1917, which is still being applied today. This legislation gave authorities the mandate to arrest anyone who willfully spoke or wrote in any manner that could be interpreted as disrupting the war effort. Don't agree with conscription and decide to mail, hand out, or openly discuss the issue to foster debate? Odds are you would be investigated and arrested under the Espionage Act. Think of Eugene Debs, the Masses, Victor Berger, Joseph Rutherford, Charles Schenck, Jacob Abrams, and many more. Perhaps you support America but harbor no love for Britain, or you make a film about the American Revolution with a provocative scene about the Wyoming Massacre, the spirit of 1776. Sorry, allies are covered under the Espionage Act as well. Many of the almost 2,000 prosecutions under the Espionage Act during the war would not have been possible without intrusive surveillance tactics. Intelligence agencies had to grow from the ground up. The Bureau of Investigation was comprised of about 300 people, and the Army's Military Intelligence Division was literally non-existent on the eve of American entrance into the war. As they expanded, intelligence agents, including soldiers, attended public and private speeches. Soldiers went undercover, such as one who broke into the National Civil Liberties Bureau's offices in New York at night to collect information, and then introduced himself to Roger Nash Baldwin the very next day as a freelance journalist for hire. Prosecutors convicted Eugene Debs for seditious speech when he offered praise to three socialists recently convicted under the Espionage Act. Postmaster General Albert S. Burleson read mail and revoked publications' mailable status that was then used by prosecutors as proof that those publishers were seditious in court cases. In America, government agents taking liberties with their authority in the name of national security is by no means unheard of. Journalists have expressed concern over businesses handing customers information to the NSA. During the First World War, some 20,000 civilian volunteers of the vigilante American Protective League accosted and detained between 300,000 and 500,000 New Yorkers over 3 days in September 1918. They detained about 60,000 men for possible draft dodging, even though they had no legal authority to do so. This same organization investigated their fellow Americans for most of the major intelligence agencies, barging into people's homes and offices. They did not get paid to do so. They believed it was their patriotic duty. One major distinction, though, is that the War on Terror has no foreseeable end, whereas the First World War ended when Germany signed the Treaty of Versailles. The surveillance state, however, did not end with the war. Intelligence gatherers continued wartime methods afterwards. They may have been more rudimentary, but they manually collated tons of data and interpreted language to apply ex-ante prevention. Government personnel continued their practices, sometimes within a legal gray area, throughout the Cold War. American democracy, with its continual dispute over the role of federal government and its citizens, has always relied on civilians' eagerness to spy on each other and ferret out those thought less than 100% American. The First World War institutionalized surveillance in the U.S., and the NSA is the latest moment in that long growth of the surveillance state. So that kind of gives you a decent overview of what was going on in World War I. That's a really interesting time in history, in American history, that I didn't get to study very much until pretty recently. But if you listen to this show on a regular basis, you know my fondness for Emma Goldman. And she talked a lot in many of her essays about the surveillance and about how that's one of the cornerstones of her critique of the state as an entity. If you don't have a right to privacy, what can you really have? And obviously, something else I want to mention and talk about, which I think I will at the end of the show instead of too much right now. People bring up George Orwell's 1984 all the time when they talk about this subject, to the point where I think a lot of people haven't read it in a while, and it seems like it's become a little bit cliche, which is unfortunate. So I'm going to share some of the quotes from that talk about it because it's really good work, really seeing the escalation of these tactics to their ultimate end of, you know, giant data banks having every piece of information on every person just in case you ever need it, which is really the essence of what's gone on with the NSA. So for now, I think I'm going to play this TED Talk, share it with you. Mikko Hipponen, TEDx Brussels. He's a very, very good speaker. And I like what he has to say here. I hope that you do too. And we can talk about it a little more afterwards. I'm also really curious to hear about, I posted on Facebook, which is pretty ironic. So I have an outline for this show stored in the Google Cloud, stored in Google Docs, as I do many of my shows, which I'm reconsidering doing for reasons that you'll hear in this talk. I'm also thinking of leaving Facebook once again. If you follow the show on Facebook, we're going to start an interesting conversation today about maybe a group of us escaping together and exploring some of the alternatives that are out there, open source on the web, not tied to some of these giant data centers, not tied to one server, not tied to one country, etc. So this is a topic that's pretty new to me. If you know more about it, I'd love to hear from you. You can feel free to give a call at 747-3807 or shoot me an email anytime at praxis@kyrs.org. So without further ado, I'm going to play Living in a Surveillance State, Mikko Hipponen at TEDx Brussels, and he will tell you a little bit more about these NSA revelations and what you need to know that you may not have heard in the American media.
The two most likely largest inventions of our generation are the internet and the mobile phone. They've changed the world. However, largely to our surprise, they also turned out to be the perfect tools for the surveillance state. It turned out that the capability to collect data, information, and connections about basically any of us and all of us is exactly what we've been hearing throughout the summer through revelations and leaks about Western intelligence agencies, mostly US intelligence agencies, watching over the rest of the world. We've heard about these starting the revelations from June 6th. Edward Snowden started leaking information, top secret classified information, from the US intelligence agencies. And we started learning about things like PRISM and XKeyscore and others. And these are examples of the kinds of programs US intelligence agencies are running right now against the whole rest of the world. And if we look back about the forecasts and on surveillance by George Orwell, well, it turns out that George Orwell was an optimist. We are right now seeing much larger scale of tracking of individual citizens than he could have ever imagined. Then this here is the infamous NSA data center in Utah. Due to be opened very soon, it will be both a supercomputing center and a data storage center. You could basically imagine it as a large hall filled with hard drives storing data they are collecting. And it's a pretty big building. How big? Well, I can give you the numbers. 140,000 square meters, but that doesn't really tell you very much. Maybe it's better to imagine it as a comparison. You think about the largest IKEA store you've ever been. This is 5 times larger. How many hard drives can you fit in an IKEA store, right? It's pretty big. We estimate that just the electricity bill for running this data center is going to be in the tens of millions of dollars a year. And this kind of wholesale surveillance means that they can collect our data and keep it basically forever, keep it for extended periods of time, keep it for years, keep it for decades. And this opens up completely new kinds of risks to us all. And what this is, is that it is wholesale blanket surveillance on everyone. Well, not exactly everyone, because the US intelligence only has a legal right to monitor foreigners. They can monitor foreigners when foreigners' data connections end up in the United States or pass through the United States. And monitoring foreigners doesn't sound too bad until you realize that I'm a foreigner and you're a foreigner. In fact, 96% of the planet are foreigners. Right? So it is wholesale blanket surveillance of all of us who use telecommunications and the internet. But don't get me wrong, there are actually types of surveillance that are okay. I love freedom, but even I agree that some surveillance is fine. If the law enforcement is trying to find a murderer, or they're trying to catch a drug lord, or trying to prevent a school shooting, and they have leads and they have suspects, then it's perfectly fine for them to tap the suspect's phone and to intercept his internet communications. I'm not arguing that at all, but that's not what programs like PRISM are about. They are not about doing surveillance on people that they have reason to suspect of some wrongdoings. They're about doing surveillance on people they know are innocent. So the four main arguments supporting surveillance like this, well, the first of all is that whenever you start discussing about these revelations, there will be naysayers trying to minimize the importance of these revelations, saying that, you know, we knew all this already. We knew it was happening. There's nothing new here. And that's not true. Don't let anybody tell you that we knew this already, because we did not know this already. Our worst fears might have been something like this, but we didn't know this was happening. Now we know for a fact it's happening. We didn't know about this. We didn't know about PRISM. We didn't know about X-Key Score. We didn't know about CyberTrans. We didn't know about Double Arrow. We did not know about SkyRider. All these different programs run by US intelligence agencies. But now we do. And we did not know that US intelligence agencies go to extremes such as infiltrating standardization bodies to sabotage encryption algorithms on purpose. And what that means is that you take something which is secure, an encryption algorithm which is so secure that if you use that algorithm to encrypt one file, nobody can decrypt that file. Even if they take every single computer on the planet just to decrypt that one file, it's going to take millions of years. So that's basically perfectly safe, uncrackable. You take something which is that good, and then you weaken it on purpose, making all of us less secure as an end result. A real-world equivalent would be that intelligence agencies would force some secret PIN code into every single house alarm so they could get into every single house because, you know, bad people might have house alarms. But it would also make all of us less secure as an end result. Backdooring encryption algorithms just boggles the mind. But of course, these intelligence agencies are doing their job. This is what they have been told to do. Do signals intelligence. Monitor telecommunications. Monitor internet traffic. That's what they're trying to do. And since most and very big part of the internet traffic today is encrypted, they're trying to find ways around the encryption. One way is to sabotage encryption algorithms, which is a great example about how US intelligence agencies are running loose. They are completely out of control, and they should be brought back under control. So what do we actually know about the leaks? Everything is based on the files leaked by Mr. Snowden. The very first PRISM slides from the beginning of June detail a collection program where the data is collected from service providers, and they actually go and name the service providers they have access to. They even have a specific date on when the collection of data began for each of the service providers. So, for example, they named that collection from Microsoft started on the 11th of September 2007, for Yahoo on the 12th of March 2008, and then others, Google, Facebook, Skype, Apple, and so on. And every single one of these companies denies. They all say that this simply isn't true. that they are not giving backdoor access to their data. Yet, we have these files. So is one of the parties lying, or is there some other alternative explanation? And one explanation would be that these parties, these service providers, are not cooperating. Instead, they've been hacked. That would explain it. They aren't cooperating, they've been hacked. In this case, they've been hacked by their own government. That might sound outlandish, but we already have cases where this has happened. For example, the case of the Flame malware, which we strongly believe was authored by the US government, and which, to spread, subverted the security of the Windows Update network. Meaning, here, the company was hacked by their own government. And there's more evidence supporting this theory as well. Der Spiegel from Germany leaked more information about the operations run by the elite hacker units operating inside these intelligence agencies. Inside NSA, the unit is called TAO, Tailored Access Operations, and inside GCHQ, which is the UK equivalent, it's called NAC, Network Analysis Center. And these recent leaks of these three slides detail an operation run by this GCHQ intelligence agency from United Kingdom, targeting a telco here in Belgium. And what this really means is that an EU country's intelligence agency is breaching the security of a telco of a fellow EU country on purpose. And they discuss it in their slides completely casually. Business as usual. Here's the primary target, here's the secondary target, here's the teaming. They probably have a team building on Thursday evening in a pub. They even use cheesy PowerPoint clip art like, you know, success when they gain access to services like this. What the hell? Then there's the argument that, okay, yes, this might be going on, but then again, other countries are doing it as well. All countries spy. And maybe that's true. Many countries spy, not all of them. But let's take an example. Let's take, for example, Sweden. I'm speaking Sweden because Sweden has a little bit similar law to the United States. When your data traffic goes through Sweden, their intelligence agency has a legal right, by the law, to intercept that traffic. All right, how many Swedish decision makers and politicians and business leaders use every day US-based services? Like, you know, run Windows or OS X, or use Facebook or LinkedIn, or store their data in clouds like iCloud or SkyDrive or Dropbox, or maybe use online services like Amazon Web Services or Salesforce. And the answer is every single Swedish business leader does that every single day. And then we turn it around. How many American leaders use Swedish webmails and cloud services? And the answer is zero. So this is not balanced. It's not balanced by any means, not even close. And when we do have the occasional European success story, even those then typically end up being sold to the United States. Like Skype used to be secure, it used to be end-to-end encrypted. Then it was sold to the United States, today it no longer is secure. So once again, we take something which is secure, and then we make it less secure on purpose, making all of us less secure as an outcome. And then the argument that the United States is only fighting terrorists. It's the war on terror. You shouldn't worry about it. Well, it's not the war on terror. Yes, part of it is war on terror. And yes, there are terrorists, and they do kill and maim, and we should fight them. But we know, through these leaks, that they've used the same techniques to listen to phone calls of European leaders, to tap the email of presidents of Mexico and Brazil, to read email traffic inside United Nations headquarters and EU Parliament. And I don't think they're trying to find terrorists from inside EU Parliament, right? It's not the war on terror. Part of it might be. And there are terrorists, but are we really thinking about terrorists as such an existential threat that we're willing to do anything at all to fight them? Are the Americans ready to throw away the Constitution and throw it into trash just because there are terrorists. And the same thing with the Bill of Rights and all the amendments and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the EU conventions on human rights and fundamental freedoms and the press freedom. Do we really think terrorism is such an existential threat we are ready to do anything at all? But people are cared about terrorists. And then they think that maybe that surveillance is okay because, you know, they have nothing to hide. Feel free to survey me if that helps. And whoever tells you that they have nothing to hide simply haven't thought about this long enough. Because we have this thing called privacy. And if you really think that you have nothing to hide, please make sure that's the first thing you tell me, because then I know that I should not trust you with any secrets, because obviously you can't keep a secret. But people are brutally honest with the internet. And when these leaks started, many people were asking me about this. And I have nothing to hide. I'm not doing anything bad or anything illegal. Yet, I have nothing that I would in particular like to share with an intelligence agency, especially a foreign intelligence agency. And if we indeed need a big brother, I would much rather have a domestic big brother than a foreign big brother. And when the leaks started, the very first thing I tweeted about this was a comment about how, you know, when you've been using search engines, you've been potentially leaking all that to US intelligence. And 2 minutes later, I got a reply by somebody called Kimberly from the United States challenging me. Like, why am I worried about this? Like, what am I sending to worry about this? Am I sending naked pictures or something? And my answer to Kimberly was that what I'm sending is none of your business. And it should be none of your government's business either. Because that's what it's about. It's about privacy. Privacy is non-negotiable. It should be built in to all the systems we use. And one thing we should all understand is that we are brutally honest with search engines. You show me your search history, and I'll find something incriminating or something embarrassing there in 5 minutes. We are more honest with search engines than we are with our families. Search engines know more about you than your family members know about you. And this is all the kind of information we're giving away. We're giving away to the United States. And surveillance changes history. We know this through examples of corrupt presidents like Nixon. Imagine if he would have had the kind of surveillance tools that are available today. And let me actually quote the president of Brazil, Ms. Dilma Rousseff. She was one of the targets of NSA surveillance. Her email was read. And she spoke at United Nations headquarters. And she said, if there's no right to privacy, there can be no true freedom of expression and opinion, and therefore, there can be no effective democracy. That's what it's about. Privacy is the building block of our democracies. And to quote a fellow security researcher, Marcus Ranum, he said that the United States is right now treating the internet as it would be treating one of its colonies. So we're back to the age of colonization, and we, the foreign users of the internet, we should think about Americans as our masters. So Mr. Snowden, he's been blamed for many things. Some are blaming him for causing problems to the US cloud industry and software companies with these revelations. And blaming Snowden for causing problems to the US cloud industry would be the equivalent of blaming Al Gore for causing global warming. So, what is there to be done? Should we worry? No, we shouldn't worry. We should be angry, because this is wrong, and it's rude, and it should not be done. But that's not going to really change the situation. What's going to change the situation for the rest of the world is to try to steer away from systems built in the United States. And that's Much easier said than done. How do you do that? A single country, any single country in Europe, cannot replace and build replacements for the US-made operating systems and cloud services. But maybe you don't have to do it alone. Maybe you can do it together with other countries. And the solution is open source. By building together open, free, secure systems, we can go around such surveillance. And then one country doesn't have to solve the problem by itself. It only has to solve one little problem. And to quote a fellow security researcher, Haron Mer, one country only has to make a small wave. But those small waves together become a tide. And the tide will lift all the boats up at the same time. And the tide we will build with secure, free, open source systems will become the tide that will lift all of us up and above the surveillance state. Thank you very much.
All right, so that was a recent, from November of this last year, TED Talk from Mikko Hipponen, who is a Finnish computer security expert, and he's written a lot of columns about computer security. He obviously advocates for certain ways to keep ourselves safe online, and his suggestion of moving toward open source, moving away from US-based technologies is a good one, but as he said, easier said than done. And as I said at the top of the hour, if you missed it, something I'm vaguely beginning to look into doing, I deleted my Facebook in early 2013, kind of sheepishly returned to Facebook with a smaller list of people, and mostly, in some ways, to connect with folks I don't know personally about this show. And other projects like that I'm involved in. But there are other ways to do it. I'm going to play another video later in the hour about just that and some specific ways that folks can do that, some alternative technologies, alternative social networking. And, you know, if you can get your real friends and family, people you'd really like to connect with to follow you somewhere else, there's really no reason to stay on Facebook. It's not a company that's likely to change. And if it does change, I believe it'll realize its need to change a little too late, and folks will already be gone. So we'll see. We'll see what happens there, and I am going to share that later on. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Praxis on KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio, talking about surveillance, state surveillance, and that last talk was kind of what's just been revealed this last year, his list of myths, that it's nothing new and that we didn't know it. It isn't necessarily new. States have been using mass surveillance for a long time to keep their populations in line, to keep tabs on what's going on, to quell certain And I am getting a call right now, and I will bring you on the air.
Yes.
I think. Okay, no, sorry. If you called the on-air number and you meant to call the office, that's okay. Just call the office. So anyway, there's a lot of reasons that a state would use surveillance, some better than others. And as he shared in the... in the video, there are real terrorists, there are real criminals. An example a lot of people use is, you know, people distributing child pornography should be stopped from doing that. Yes, absolutely. So this is one of those tricky problems that, some surveillance, maybe mass surveillance of absolutely everyone on Earth, not so much. So something that's been used since the days of reading people's mail, showing up at people's homes, sitting in a van across the street from someone's home, the things we've all seen in, crime shows or anything like that, is very real. And oftentimes, something that's interesting, I was just reading an article, though I can't pull it up online because I read it in print in a publication that's only in print for many of these reasons, doesn't want to share online, that this woman who's an activist in California, she tried to keep her online presence minimum because of her concerns about this, and found by chance a little card in her mail that was an instruction to the postal carrier to monitor her mail. And she just happened to find it and didn't really know what to do with it. So knows that her mail's being read and is in the process of figuring out what to do about that exactly, figuring out who's reading it, why they'd want to read it. And it's that kind of atmosphere that just can destabilize all kinds of movements for changing cultures like this, for, you know, abolishing states. I mean, if we're going to talk about the big movement to solve a lot, some of these problems that no one really wants to talk about, to destabilize those things, paranoia can be a really important tool. And that's something Orwell explores in 1984. It's something that's been explored in a lot of other works. Another great sci-fi that folks may have seen in film version or read is A Scanner Darkly by Philip K. Dick. And that's kind of more about the war on drugs. It was written before the war on drugs really began, but it made some great predictions there and talks a lot about surveillance, infiltration, trusting people, you know, in a society where you want to build relationships with people, because that's the foundation of, you know, human contentment, really, in a lot of ways. And you don't know who's a spy and who's not. It makes things a little crazy. So there's kind of a country by country rundown of places that use mass surveillance and state enforced surveillance. And I'll just run through a few of those. Some we know better than others. Many people know, you know, the Great Firewall of China, know China's very overt. It's a country involved in active surveillance of news, just blocking information from coming into the country, shutting down the connections of those who access encrypted networks, who access information from other countries. I'd say that China's kind of a counterpart to the U.S. in that the U.S. says, yes, all of our technology is open. Anyone can use the internet. You can use it however you want, with some limitations. But the backside of that is what Hipponen was talking about in that talk. That sure, yeah, come in, tell us everything, access whatever you're interested in. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. You know, just tell us everything. And one could argue that that's been more useful to the U.S. than China's simple blockade of information. So the EU, the right to privacy, this is from a wiki article on mass surveillance, to be honest with you. Wikipedia is a good example of kind of an open technology built by everyone rather than this proprietary model that's kind of nestled into this whole discussion. But at the same time, I'm feeding all of my Wikipedia searches through Google, so they know what I've been searching for. Hopefully it's not too embarrassing. The right to privacy is a highly developed area of law in Europe. The Data Protection Directive regulates the processing of personal data within the European Union. For comparison, the U.S. has no data protection law that is comparable to this. The EU is considering freezing data sharing arrangements with the U.S. because of revelations about mass surveillance. The EU executive is drafting new Europe-wide data protection rules requiring U.S. internet companies operating in the EU to obtain permission to transfer data to the U.S. and to restrict U.S. intelligence access to it. I think that, you know, I understand their feeling there, but the U.S. government has a pretty notable lack of regard for any overarching directive put towards them. He mentioned, Hipponen mentioned in his talk, you know, that by doing this spying, the U.S. is throwing the Constitution in the trash, the Bill of Rights, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And he goes on to mention some other more international in scope legal frameworks. And yeah, anyone who thinks the U.S. really cares about the International Declaration of Human Rights is needs to do a little more research. It's not something they're into. And so, you know, the places we tend to hear the most about when we hear about state surveillance, we think of Soviet Russia. You know, we think of this overt watching of people, overt paranoia. Iran's on this list. the construction of a parallel Iranian internet with high connection speed but fully monitored and censored is almost complete there. So that's the China model of intercepting people's information, finding individuals who attempt to subvert the system, and keeping the system controlled as far as information. So that's kind of an overview of what this is. This is kind of another little bit of history from the U.S. Again, starting in World War I, when the Bureau of Investigation, later to morph into the Federal Bureau of Investigation, emerged. During both World Wars, every international telegram from or to the United States sent through companies such as Western Union was reviewed by the U.S. military. After the wars were over, surveillance continued in programs such as the Black Chamber following World War I, Project Shamrock following World War II, and as we've discussed on this show, and as I hope people know, the most famous of these programs, COINTELPRO, conducted between 1956 and 1971, targeted various subversive organizations. Individual activists, including Albert Einstein, Martin Luther King Jr., that program spiraled from mere surveillance to actual targeted assassination. Incredible levels of infiltration, destabilization of these groups, which were leading very promising, very promising conversations and actions toward a completely different paradigm in the U.S., and those in control didn't really want to cede their power. And that's kind of what this is all about. And that's where it comes back a bit to 1984, to other sci-fi, other works like this that explore these topics. It's about power at the end of the day, and it's about instilling fear in people. Or ideally, I should find the quote when I'm playing the next video. Ideally, controlling thought to a level where you don't need to worry about subversive characters because you've created an environment in which they simply emerge less and less frequently, and that's true in 1984. Again, if you haven't read that book since high school, pick it up. It'll take a couple days, maybe a few days, depending on your speed, and it's a good thing to revisit. So, and my favorite quote about power from that book I found. I can't find my copy of it. If you're a person who has it, please return it to me. And here is a quote. This is toward the end of the book when O'Brien's explaining when the the wall is kind of coming down and Winston's actually being interrogated, and he finally has some things explained to him about the nature of the system that he's been born into. Now I will tell you the answer to my question. It is this. The party seeks power entirely for its own sake. We are not interested in the good of others. We are interested solely in power, pure power. What pure power means, you will understand presently. We are different from the oligarchies of the past in that we know what we are doing. All the others, even those who resembled ourselves, were cowards and hypocrites. The German Nazis and the Russian communists came very close to us in their methods, but they never had the courage to recognize their own motives. They pretended, perhaps they even believed, that they had seized power unwillingly and for a limited time, and that just around the corner there lay a paradise where human beings would be free and equal. We are not like that. We know what no one ever seizes power with the intention of relinquishing it. Power is not a means, it is an end. One does not establish a dictatorship in order to safeguard a revolution. One makes the revolution in order to establish the dictatorship. The object of persecution is persecution. The object of torture is torture. The object of power is power. Now you begin to understand me. So with that, I'm going to go to this other video. It's Aben Moglen on Facebook, Google, and government surveillance. And this is a little bit older. This is before Edward Snowden leaked the leaks that he leaked. And he's talking about the Publica conference in Berlin in May 2012. And just talking from a technical standpoint, this is where I'm about to do a lot more research and a lot more learning, the technical standpoint of how all of this works. I think a lot of folks who have never been in the engineering, the programming world, really have this pretty superstitious notion of how all of this works, as far as the internet and as far as information sharing networks. We may have a vague notion, but to most people, you know, the IT guy at your office is like some kind of magician who just makes things happen when you couldn't make them happen, you know, from striking your computer monitor. So I think we all have a lot to learn, and it's sort of a responsibility to know about the technology that you're using. At least I think it is. So that's part of what I'm going to be doing some more of, and I'd love for you to join me temporarily, at least on Facebook, facebook.com/praxisradio. You can connect there, and we can plot our escape from centralized networks together. So here is Eben Moglen on Facebook, Google, and government surveillance.
It's not a bad idea to share information with the people you want to share with. It's not a bad idea to use the open web. It's a really bad idea to share all your information in a system in which one guy gets a copy of everything. What we would call in cryptography a man-in-the-middle attack. I want to share some things with my actual friends. I want to share some things with everybody in the world equally. But why would I want to share with my friends and Mr. Zuckerberg, or with the entire world and Mr. Zuckerberg? The other thing that we tend to forget is that there are two kinds of information. There's the information we share, and there's the information about who accesses what we share. The web server log is the most important data on most web servers. On the web server is pictures of my cat. On the log is pictures of who looks at me when I'm with my cats. At Facebook, if you run the place, you can tell who's going to have a love affair before the people know, because you know that girl is obsessively checking Facebook page of boy, or boy is obsessively checking Facebook page of boy. And so you know what is happening before it happens, because they think they're sharing with one another, but you're the one keeping the log. It's a really bad idea to share with people in a way which gives one person all the logs. I don't think there was ever anything wrong with living in the Soviet Union and distributing samizdat, but there was something really wrong with being in the Soviet Union and distributing samizdat through KGB. That's the difference. Yes, that's correct. I gave a talk about Facebook to college students in America. I called it From Lubyanka to Harvard Yard. Why do you build a prison and torture people? Why do you have informants? You build a social networking system badly designed, and people bring you everything. They don't think they're bringing it to you. They think they're bringing it to their friends, but they're actually bringing it to Lubyanka, and Lubyanka is giving it to their friends. This is not a good way to work. It's not bad to have social networking. Social networking is wonderful and important. It changes human life. It's bad to have it in a badly designed way.
Will Facebook still be around 10 years from now?
Facebook will not have success for 10 more years. Facebook will have success until its membership starts dropping. Once its membership starts dropping, it will be in deep trouble. The theory of Facebook is nobody can leave, because they'd have to leave their friends behind. Once we create federated social networking with soft migration, Facebook will not be able to say that anymore, and its death cycle will begin. This was the importance of the software called Diaspora. Diaspora is correctly engineered with respect to the one essential question: how do I leave Facebook, Flickr, Twitter without leaving my friends and followers behind? This is the thing that, as an engineering matter, we need to understand. As people use more and more social networking, they don't just use one service. They don't just use Facebook or Google Plus. They use that and Twitter or Identica or this or that. So they pretty soon start using feed aggregators because they need to aggregate the various social network feeds they get. The aggregator then is the crucial middleware in the same way that the browser is the crucial middleware in the web. So you build an aggregator, which is basically what Diaspora's front side is. And you say, okay, so you have all these feeds from your friends. If your friends are also using Diaspora, then you're going to share in an encrypted way, privately. And for your friends who aren't using it yet, you'll bounce off the public services, Facebook, Twitter, Flickr, whatever. Over time, as more and more of your friends switch to Diaspora, you disappear from the public services slowly and gracefully. So you never lose your friends, but you shift away. Why do they start using Diaspora? It's not even because they are worried about Facebook privacy. It's just a good aggregator, and they need one because as they do more social networking, they need better aggregation. So in the same way that Firefox frees people from a net created by Microsoft, a web we own, front page does this, therefore the browser is broken if it doesn't do the same thing, and very softly they moved away. Because Firefox meant that if you got tired of IE security, or your IT guys got tired of IT security problems created by IE, then you could move. The same thing will happen with social networking. Whether we succeed in Freedom Box, whether Diaspora, whether GNU Social, whether a million other possible varieties, because we have many talented teams working on better social networking around the planet, many, 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 one of them will begin to be an aggregation system that other people like to use. Maybe tied to a browser, maybe not tied to a browser. And as people begin to adopt that aggregation system, they will softly move to secure sharing. At some point, there will come a day when Facebook has a maximum number of users. 1 billion, 1.5 billion, 1.7 billion, I don't know. But once it starts to fall, it will come apart quickly. Because then people will realize you don't have to leave your friends. Why do we stay with this Facebook? What is it that the service gives us that's worth the spying? And the numbers are not particularly impressive. We know now from the IPO documents for sure, Facebook takes in $4.40 per year per user. Right? $4.40. €3.25, right? That's not very much money. They're not providing anything that's worth all that much once we have a good substitute and people don't lose touch with their friends by shifting, they'll naturally shift. 10 years is a good outside bet about the maximum length of Facebook's lasting.
What threat is imposed by the massive federal data center that the NSA is currently building in Bluffdale, Utah?
That Utah federal data center is not meant for tracking packets. It's meant for taking in databases that already exist. What will happen when that federal data center exists is that every day, American Express, the other credit card companies, the travel records, all sorts of commercial databases will be duplicated in. In order to track packets, you have to be somewhere where packets are stolen. You have to be on a U.S. embassy roof or inside a telecommunications operator. They will then bring back all those packet dumps and add them to all the other information they possess about everybody. So we will be looking at effectively a government that copies Google, copies Facebook, instead of having to rely upon putting their code in over there. Think about it this way. There are a variety of databases around the world that you'd like to run BI code on top of. You'd like to data mine those databases. Google is really important. Facebook is really important. What you want to do is get code in. But if you're the United States government, you'll take the whole database. Other people will have to put code in Facebook, and Facebook will show that code to the US government. So if BNDE wants to look in Facebook, or the Turkish secret police want to look in Facebook, they'll be able to put code in by promising Facebook favors in return, and the US government will look over their shoulder to see what they are looking for. It, however, will not be showing Facebook what it is looking for, because it will duplicate the entire database and then run the BI code on top of it. That's what's happening here. Think of it as Echelon moves into Facebook and into Google, and the United States government doesn't have Echelon anymore. It keeps all the data, and it doesn't show anybody what it's searching for. That's the real outcome of the Utah federal Google.
And that's just part of that interview. Yasu News, again, from 2012 at the Republica conference in Berlin. Ibn Moglen talking about all these various dangers of centralized networks, doing a fairly good job of simplifying some pretty complex concepts that most of us know very little about. Again, I'd urge everyone to learn more about those. That includes myself. He is a professor of law and legal history at Columbia. He's the founder, director, counsel, and chairman of the Software Freedom Law Center, whose client list includes numerous pro bono clients, such as the Free Software Foundation. So he's a figure in this open source movement in defending people's ability to have privacy and still use the internet. And he talks about, I mean, his main work and his main perspective is that free software, free use, free exchange is a requirement for a free society, which makes sense, especially one in which we're surrounded by and dependent upon technical devices. Only if controlling these devices is open to all via free software can we balance power equally. So that was that's a quote of his. And we've seen this in recent years. We saw it during the Arab Spring. We saw it during Occupy in the U.S., of content that people share being blocked at the request of governments by these companies such as Facebook, such as Twitter. I've seen it. I've seen posts of mine disappear from Facebook with no explanation, and I have other friends who have had this happen as well. As he pointed out, if someone else is looking over the shoulder and has access, and it's one guy, it's not literally one guy, but it's the, you know, the equivalent of it's one agency, one person. That's just not a good plan for anyone. And I think because it happened a bit gradually, and because this technology was introduced into our lives gradually, and we co-adapted with it, especially my generation has definitely adapted to this technology. And the generation below me, you know, there's 3-year-olds who can use iPads much more effectively than their parents who have this technology just as an extension of their bodies and their minds. And that has a lot of interesting implications when we have these increasingly panicking, I think in some cases, states as this global connection to others enhances, you know, the need to have nation states in the 20th century notion of that sort of begins to disappear. And as companies, you know, take precedence over states, that has all kinds of strange implications too. So there's a lot of weird stuff going on. What a strange and interesting time to be on Earth, huh? So that's just some of the shenanigans folks are up to. An aspect of this I think is really interesting. Many of the original architects of the concept of a global network, of the internet, were basically, for lack of a better description, were acid heads from the 60s. They were these guys who had been involved in LSD trials, in the hippie movement, in all of those, in the counterculture of the 60s. Many of those people, as COINTELPRO demolished some of those organizations, as the energy sort of petered out, as Vietnam ended, many, many, many of those people channeled their interest in bettering the world, in connecting humanity to one another, into programming and into developing these networks. There's a really fascinating documentary about it that took me a few times to finish because the voiceover's hypnotic, but it's online and I will share that with you. So it's interesting to see how these people's vision, and really if you read about open source, the open source activists of the world, the hackers involved in that, the people who build this, are probably some of the most passionate people in regards to wanting freedom in the true sense of think whatever you want, don't, you know, of freeing people's minds, of connecting people to one another, which really, like, that's the most beautiful thing about the internet, is we've been able to see that we really are all the same. around the world, we love to look at cats being weird. You know, we love babies dancing. We love space. You know, we want to explore nature, ironically, is what a lot of it's about. As we use this technology that's counter to that. But that's the vision that I think a lot of these early pioneers of this technology had, and that's put in danger by totalitarian and semi-totalitarian states who want to maintain their power. This connection that people have is probably the most viable threat to those systems that we've ever seen. So that explains a lot of why they'd want to spy. And yeah, I hope that this was interesting for folks. That hour kind of went by quickly for me with those talks. And yeah, the main, I think that what we should also keep in mind that that Mikko Hipponen brought up in his talk at the beginning of the hour is this idea that the U.S.'s policies on this are just an extension of the tradition, the not very long, but very intense tradition of colonialism that this country has. This idea that we are special and we are going to break agreements that everyone else has made because we're just more awesome, and we're going to read all your data and we're going to store everything and try and stop us. So hopefully people bailing out of that system, the rise of open source, the protection of it by these activists will prevail. So thanks so much for listening. This has been Praxis on KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio. If you'd like to contact me ever about an idea for the show, a question, do email me, praxis@kyrs.org. You can also connect on Facebook for now at facebook.com/praxisradio. You can find the podcast at kyrs.org and a full archive of episodes at praxisradio509.podomatic.com. Thanks a lot, and I'll be back next week, 10 a.m.